while Eva tested and argued with her men, leaving them feeling as though they had been in combat with a worthy if amiable foe, Hannah rubbed no edges, made no demands, made the man feel as though he were complete and wonderful just as he was. He didn't need fixing, and so he relaxed and swooned in the Hannah light that shone on him simply because he was. If the man entered and Hannah was carrying a coal scuttle up from the basement, she handled it in such a way that it became a gesture of love. He made no move to help her with it, simply because he wanted to see how her thighs looked when she bent to put it down, knowing that she wanted him to see them too. But since in that crowded house there were no places for private and spontaneous lovemaking, Hannah would take the man down into the cellar in the summer, where it was cool, back behind the coal bin and the newspapers, or in the winter they would step into the pantry and stand up against the shelves she had filled with canned goods, or lie on the flour sack just under the rows of tiny green peppers. When those places were not available, she would slip into the seldom used parlor, or even up to her bedroom. She liked the last place least, not because Sula slept in the room with her, but because her lovemate's tendency was always to fall asleep afterward, and Hannah was fastidious about whom she slept with. She would fuck practically anything, but sleeping with someone implied for her a measure of trust and a definite commitment. So she ended up a daylight lover, and it was only once, actually, that Sula came home from school and found her mother in the bed, curled spoon in the arms of a man. Seeing her step so easily into the pantry and emerge looking precisely as she did when she entered, only happier, taught Sula that sex was pleasant and frequent, but otherwise unremarkable. Outside the house, where children giggled about underwear, the message was different. So she watched her mother's face and the face of the men when they opened the pantry door and made up her own mind. Hannah exasperated the women in the town, the good women who said, "One thing I can't stand is a nasty woman." The whores, who were hard put to find trade among black men anyway, and who resented Hannah's generosity. The middling women, who had both husbands and affairs, because Hannah seemed too unlike them, having no passion attached to her relationships and being wholly incapable of jealousy. Hannah's friendships with women were, of course, seldom and short-lived, and the newly married couples, whom her mother took in, soon learned what a hazard she was. She could break up a marriage before it had even become one. She would make love to the new groom and wash his wife's dishes all in an afternoon. What she wanted after Rikus died, and what she succeeded in having more often than not, was some touching every day. The men, surprisingly, never gossiped about her. She was unquestionably a kind and generous woman. And that, coupled with her extraordinary beauty and funky elegance of manner, made them defend her and protect her from any vitriol that newcomers or their wives might spill. Eva's last child, Plum, to whom she hoped to bequeath everything, floated in a constant swaddle of love and affection until 1917, when he went to war. He returned to the States in 1919, but did not get back to Medallion until 1920. He wrote letters from New York, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, full of promises of homecomings, but there was obviously something wrong. Finally, some 2 or 3 days after Christmas, he arrived with just the shadow of his old dip-down walk. His hair had been neither cut nor combed in months. His clothes were pointless, and he had no socks. But he did have a black bag, a paper sack, and a sweet, sweet smile. Everybody welcomed him and gave him a warm room next to Tar Baby's and waited for him to tell them whatever it was he wanted them to know. They waited in vain for his telling, but not long for the knowing. His habits were much like Tar Baby's, but there were no bottles, and Plum was sometimes cheerful and animated. Hannah watched, and Eva waited. Then he began to steal from them, take trips to Cincinnati, and sleep for days in his room with the record player going. He got even thinner, since he ate only snatches of things at beginnings or endings of meals. It was Hannah who found the bent spoon black from steady cooking. So late one night in 1921, Eva got up from her bed and put on her clothes. Hoisting herself up on her crutches, she was amazed to find that she could still manage them, although the pain in her armpits was severe. She practiced a few steps around the room, then opened the door. Slowly, she manipulated herself down the long flights of stairs, two crutches under her left arm, the right hand grasping the banister. The sound of her foot booming in comparison to the delicate pat of the crutch tip. On each landing, she stopped for breath. Annoyed at her physical condition, she closed her eyes and removed the crutches from under her arms to relieve the unaccustomed pressure. At the foot of the stairs, she redistributed her weight between the crutches and swooped on through the front room, to the dining room, to the kitchen, swinging and swooping like a giant heron, so graceful, sailing about in its own habitat, but awkward and comical when it folded its wings and tried to walk. With a swing and a swoop, she arrived at Plum's door and pushed it open with the tip of one crutch. He was lying in bed, barely visible in the light, coming from a single bulb. Eva swung over to the bed and propped her crutches at its foot. She sat down and gathered Plum into her arms. He woke, but only slightly. "Hey, man, hey, you holding me, Mama?" His voice was drowsy and amused. He chuckled as though he had heard some private joke. Eva held him closer and began to rock back and forth. She rocked him, her eyes wandering around his room. There in the corner was a half-eaten, store-bought cherry pie. Balled-up candy wrappers and empty pop bottles peeped from under the dresser. On the floor by her foot was a glass of Strawberry Crush and a Liberty magazine. Rocking, rocking, listening to Plum's occasional chuckles, Eva let her memory spin, loop, and fall. Plum in the tub that time as she leaned over him. He reached up and dripped water into her bosom and laughed. She was angry, but not too, and laughed with him. "Mama, you're so pretty. You're so pretty, Mama." Eva lifted her tongue to the edge of her lip to stop the tears from running into her mouth, rocking, rocking. Later, she laid him down and looked at him a long time. Suddenly she was thirsty and reached for the glass of Strawberry Crush. She put it to her lips and discovered it was blood-tainted water and threw it to the floor. Plum woke up and said, "Hey, Mama, why aren't you going back to bed? I'm all right. Didn't I tell you I'm all right? Go on now." "I'm going, Plum," she said. She shifted her weight and pulled her crutches toward her. Swinging and swooping, she left his room. She dragged herself to the kitchen and made grating noises. Plum, on the rim of a warm, light sleep, was still chuckling. "Mama, she sure was something." He felt twilight. Now there seemed to be some kind of wet light traveling over his legs and stomach with a deeply attractive smell. It wound itself, this wet light, all about him, splashing and running into his skin. He opened his eyes and saw what he imagined was the great wing of an eagle pouring a wet lightness over him, some kind of baptism, some kind of blessing, he thought. Everything is going to be all right, it said. Knowing that it was so, he closed his eyes and sank back into the bright hole of sleep. Eva stepped back from the bed and let the crutches rest under her arms. She rolled a bit of newspaper into a tight stick about 6 inches long, lit it, and threw it onto the bed where the kerosene-soaked plum lay in snug delight. Quickly, as the whoosh of flames engulfed him, she shut the door and made her slow and painful journey back to the top of the house. Just as she got to the third landing, she could hear Hannah in some child's voice. She swung along, not even listening to the voices of alarm and the cries of the Deweys. By the time she got to her bed, someone was bounding up the stairs after her. Hannah opened the door. "Plum! Plum! He's burning! Mama, we can't even open the door! Mama!" Eva looked into Hannah's eyes. "Is my baby burning?" The two women did not speak, for the eyes of each were enough for the other. Then Hannah closed hers and ran toward the voices of neighbors calling for water. 1922. It was too cool for ice cream. A hill wind was blowing dust and empty camel's wrappers about their ankles. It pushed their dresses into the creases of their behinds, then lifted the hems to peek at their cotton underwear. They were on their way to Edna Finch's Mellow House, an ice cream parlor catering to nice folks, where even children would feel comfortable, you know, even though it was right next to Reba's Grill and just one block down from the time-and-a-half pool hall. It sat in the curve of Carpenter's Road, which, in four blocks, made up all the sporting life available in the bottom. Old men and young ones draped themselves in front of the Elmira Theater, Irene's Palace of Cosmetology, the pool hall, the grill, and the other sagging business enterprises that lined the street. On sills, on stoops, on crates and broken chairs, they sat tasting their teeth and waiting for something to distract them. Every passerby, every motor car, every alteration in stance caught their attention and was commented on. Particularly, they watched women. When a woman approached, the older men tipped their hats. The younger ones opened and closed their thighs. But all of them, whatever their age, watched her retreating view with interest. Nell and Sula walked through this valley of eyes, chilled by the wind and heated by the embarrassment of appraising stares. The old men looked at their stalk-like legs, dwelled on the cords in the back of their knees, and remembered old dance steps they had not done in 20 years. In their lust, which age had turned to kindness, they moved their lips as though to stir up the taste of young sweat on tight skin. Pig meat. The words were in all their minds, and one of them, one of the young ones, said it aloud, softly, but definitively, and there was no mistaking the compliment. His name was Ajax, a 21-year-old pool haunt of sinister beauty. Graceful and economical in every movement, he held a place of envy with men of all ages for his magnificently foul mouth. In fact, he seldom cursed, and the epithets he chose were dull, even harmless. His reputation was derived from the way he handled the words. When he said hell, he hit the H with his lungs and the impact was greater than the achievement of the most imaginative foul mouth in the town. He could say shit with a nastiness impossible to imitate. So when he said pig meat, as Nell and Sula passed, they guarded their eyes, lest someone see their delight. It was not really Edna Finch's ice cream that made them brave the stretch of those panther eyes. Years later, their own eyes would glaze as they cupped their chins in remembrance of the inchworm smiles, the squatting haunches, the track rail legs straddling broken chairs, the cream-colored trousers marking with a mere seam the place where the mystery curled, those smooth vanilla crotches invited them, those lemon-yellow gabardines beckoned to them. They moved toward the ice cream parlor like tightrope walkers, as thrilled by the possibility of a slip as by the maintenance of tension and balance. The least sideways glance, the merest toe stub, could pitch them into those creamy haunches spread wide with welcome. Somewhere beneath all of that daintiness, chambered in all that neatness, lay the thing that clotted their dreams. Which was only fitting, for it was in dreams that the two girls had first met. Long before Edna Finch's mellow house opened, even before they marched through the chocolate halls of Garfield Primary School, out onto the playground, and stood facing each other through the ropes of the one vacant swing. Go on. No, you go. They had already made each other's acquaintance in the delirium of their noon dreams. They were solitary little girls whose loneliness was so profound it intoxicated them and sent them stumbling into technicolored visions that always included a presence, a someone who, quite like the dreamer, shared the delight of the dream. When Nell, an only child, sat on the steps of her back porch, surrounded by the high silence of her mother's incredibly orderly house, feeling the neatness pointing at her back, she studied the poplars and fell easily into a picture of herself lying on a flowered bed, tangled in her own hair, waiting for some fiery prince. He approached, but never quite arrived. But always, watching the dream along with her, were some smiling, sympathetic eyes, someone as interested as she herself in the flow of her imagined hair, the thickness of the mattress of flowers, the voiled sleeves that closed below her elbows in gold-threaded cuffs. Similarly, Sula, also an only child, but wedged into a household of throbbing disorder, constantly awry with things, people, voices, and the slamming of doors, spent hours in the attic behind a roll of linoleum, galloping through her own mind on a gray and white horse, tasting sugar and smelling roses in full view of a someone who shared both the taste and the speed. So when they met, first in those chocolate halls and next through the ropes of the swing, they felt the ease and comfort of old friends, because each had discovered years before that they were neither white nor male, and that all freedom and triumph was forbidden to them. They had set about creating something else to be. Their meeting was fortunate, for it let them use each other to grow on. Daughters of distant mothers and incomprehensible fathers, Sula's because he was dead, Nell's because he wasn't, they found in each other's eyes the intimacy they were looking for. Nell Wright and Sula Peace were both 12 in 1922, wishbone thin and easy-assed. Nell was the color of wet sandpaper, just dark enough to escape the blows of the pitch-black True Bloods and the contempt of old women who worried about such things as bad blood mixtures and knew that the origins of a mule and a mulatto were one and the same. Had she been any lighter-skinned, She would have needed either her mother's protection on the way to school or a streak of mien to defend herself. Sula was a heavy brown with large, quiet eyes, one of which featured a birthmark that spread from the middle of the lid toward the eyebrow, shaped something like a stemmed rose. It gave her otherwise plain face a broken excitement and a blue blade threat, like the keloid scar of the razored man who sometimes played checkers with her grandmother. The birthmark was to grow darker as the years passed, but now it was the same shade as her gold-flecked eyes, which to the end were as steady and clean as rain. Their friendship was as intense as it was sudden. They found relief in each other's personality. Although both were unshaped, formless things, Nell seemed stronger and more consistent than Sula, who could hardly be counted on to sustain any emotion for more than 3 minutes. Yet there was one time when that was not true, when she held on to her mood for weeks. But even that was in defense of Nell. Four white boys in their early teens, sons of some newly arrived Irish people, occasionally entertained themselves in the afternoon by harassing black schoolchildren. With shoes that pinched and woolen knickers that made red rings on their calves, they had come to this valley with their parents, believing as they did that it was a promised land, green and shimmering with welcome. What they found was a strange accent, a pervasive fear of their religion, and firm resistance to their attempts to find work. With one exception, the older residents of Medallion scorned them. The one exception was the black community. Although some of the Negroes had been in Medallion before the Civil War, the town didn't even have a name then. If they had any hatred for these newcomers, it didn't matter, because it didn't show. As a matter of fact, baiting them was the one activity that the white Protestant residents concurred in. In part, their place in this world was secured only when they echoed the old residents' attitude toward blacks. These particular boys caught Nell once and pushed her from hand to hand until they grew tired of the frightened, helpless face. Because of that incident, Nell's route home from school became elaborate. She, and then Sula, managed to duck them for weeks until a chilly day in November, when Sula said, "Let's us go on home the shortest way." Nell blinked, but acquiesced. They walked up the street until they got to the bend of Carpenter's Road, where the boys lounged on a disused well. Spotting their prey, the boys sauntered forward as though there were nothing in the world on their minds but the gray sky. Hardly able to control their grins, they stood like a gate, blocking the path. When the girls were 3 feet in front of the boys, Sula reached into her coat pocket and pulled out Eva's paring knife. The boys stopped short, exchanged looks, and dropped all pretense of innocence. This was going to be better than they thought. They were going to try and fight back, and with a knife. Maybe they could get an arm around one of their waists or tear. Sula squatted down in the dirt road and put everything down on the ground, her lunch pail, her reader, her mittens, her slate. Holding the knife in her right hand, she pulled the slate toward her and pressed her left forefinger down hard on its edge. Her aim was determined, but inaccurate. She slashed off only the tip of her finger. The four boys stared open-mouthed at the wound and the scrap of flesh like a button mushroom curling in the cherry blood that ran into the corners of the slate. Sula raised her eyes to them. Her voice was quiet. "If I can do that to myself, what you suppose I'll do to you?" The shifting dirt was the only way Nell knew that they were moving away. She was looking at Sula's face, which seemed miles and miles away. But toughness was not their quality. Adventuresomeness was, and a mean determination to explore everything that interested them, from one-eyed chickens high-stepping in their penned yards to Mr. Buckland Reed's gold teeth. From the sound of sheets flapping in the wind to the labels on Tarbaby's wine bottles. And they had no priorities. They could be distracted from watching a fight with mean razors by the glorious smell of hot tar being poured by roadmen 200 yards away. In the safe harbor of each other's company, they could afford to abandon the ways of other people and concentrate on their own perceptions of things. When Mrs. Wright reminded Nell to pull her nose, she would do it enthusiastically, but without the least hope in the world. "Why are you sitting there, honey? Go ahead and pull your nose." "It hurts, Mama. Don't you want a nice nose when you grow up?" After she met Sula, Nell slid the clothespin under the blanket as soon as she got in the bed. And although there was still the hateful hot comb to suffer through each Saturday evening, its consequences, smooth hair, no longer interested her. Joined in mutual admiration, they watched each day as though it were a movie arranged for their amusement. The new theme they were now discovering was men. So they met regularly, without even planning it, to walk down the road to Edna Finch's mellow house, even though it was too cool for ice cream. Then summer came, a summer limp with the weight of blossomed things, heavy sunflowers weeping over fences, iris curling and browning at the edges far away from their purple hearts, ears of corn letting their auburn hair wind down to their stalks. And the boys, the beautiful, beautiful boys, who dotted the landscape like jewels, split the air with their shouts in the field, and thickened the river with their shining wet backs. Even their footsteps left a smell of smoke behind. It was in that summer, the summer of their 12th year, the summer of the beautiful black boys, that they became skittish, frightened, and bold all at the same time. In that mercury mood in July, Sula and Nell wandered about the bottom barefoot looking for mischief. They decided to go down by the river where the boys sometimes swam. Nell waited on the porch of 7 Carpenter's Road while Sula ran into the house to go to the toilet. On the way up the stairs, she passed the kitchen where Hannah sat with 2 friends, Patsy and Valentine. The 2 women were fanning themselves and watching Hannah put down some dough, all talking casually about one thing and another, and had gotten round when Sula passed by to the problems of child-rearing. They are pain. "Yeah, wish I'd listened to Mama. She told me not to have them too soon. Any time at all is too soon for me. Oh, I don't know. My Rudy minds his daddy, just wild with me. Be glad when he growed and gone." Hannah smiled and said, "Shut your mouth. You love the ground he pee on." "Sure I do, but he's still a pain. Can't help loving your own child no matter what they do." "Well, Hester grown now and I can't say love is exactly what I feel." "Sure you do. You love her like I love Sula. I just don't like her. That's the difference." "Guess so. Liking them is another thing." "Sure, they're different people, you know." She only heard Hannah's words, and the pronouncement sent her flying up the stairs. In bewilderment, she stood at the window, fingering the curtain edge, aware of a sting in her eye. Nell's call floated up and into the window, pulling her away from dark thoughts, back into the bright, hot daylight. They ran most of the way, heading toward the wide part of the river where trees grouped themselves in families, darkening the earth below. They passed some boys swimming and clowning in the water, shrouding their words in laughter. They ran in the sunlight, creating their own breeze, which pressed their dresses into their damp skin, reaching a kind of square of 4 leaf-locked trees, which promised cooling. They flung themselves into the 4-cornered shade to taste their lip sweat and contemplate the wildness that had come upon them so suddenly. They lay in the grass, their foreheads almost touching, their bodies stretched away from each other at a 180-degree angle. Sula's head rested on her arm, an undone braid coiled around her wrist. Nell leaned on her elbows and worried long blades of grass with her fingers. Underneath their dresses, flesh tightened and shivered in the high coolness, their small breasts just now beginning to create some pleasant discomfort when they were lying on their stomachs. Sula lifted her head and joined Nell in the grass play. In concert, without ever meeting each other's eyes, they stroked the blades up and down, up and down. Nell found a thick twig and with her thumbnail pulled away its bark until it was stripped to a smooth, creamy innocence. Sula looked about and found one too. When both twigs were undressed, Nell moved easily to the next stage and began tearing up rooted grass to make a bare spot of earth. When a generous clearing was made, Sula traced intricate patterns in it with her twig. At first, Nell was content to do the same, but soon she grew impatient and poked her twig rhythmically and intensely into the earth, making a small, neat hole that grew deeper and wider with the least manipulation of her twig. Sula copied her, and soon each had a hole the size of a cup. Nell began a more strenuous digging, and, rising to her knee, was careful to scoop out the dirt as she made her hole deeper. Together they worked until the two holes were one and the same. When the depression was the size of a small dishpan, Nell's twig broke. With a gesture of disgust, she threw the pieces into the hole they had made. Sula threw hers in, too. Nell saw a bottle cap and tossed it in as well. Each then looked around for more debris to throw into the hole, paper, bits of glass, butts of cigarettes, until all of the small, defiling things they could find were collected there. Carefully, they replaced the soil and covered the entire grave with uprooted grass. Neither one had spoken a word. They stood up, stretched, then gazed out over the swift, dull water as an unspeakable restlessness and agitation held them. At the same instant, each girl heard footsteps in the grass. A little boy in two big knickers was coming up from the lower bank of the river. He stopped when he saw them and picked his nose. "Your mama told you to stop eating snot chicken," Nell hollered at him through cupped hands. "Shut up," he said, still picking. "Come up here and say that. Leave him alone, Nell. Come here, chicken. Let me show you something." "No. You scared we're gonna take your booger away?" "Leave him alone," I said. "Come on, chicken. Look, I'll help you climb a tree." Chicken looked at the tree Sula was pointing to, a big double beech with low branches and lots of bends for sitting. He moved slowly toward her. "Come on, chicken, I'll help you up." Still picking his nose, his eyes wide, he came to where they were standing. Sula took him by the hand and coaxed him along. When they reached the base of the beech, she lifted him to the first branch, saying, go on, I got you." She followed the boy, steadying him when he needed it, with her hand and her reassuring voice. When they were as high as they could go, Sula pointed to the far side of the river. "See? Bet you never saw that far before, did you?" "Uh-uh." "Now look down there." They both leaned a little and peered through the leaves at Nell, standing below, squinting up at them. From their height, she looked small and foreshortened. Chicken Little laughed. "Y'all better come on down before you break your neck," Nell hollered. "I ain't never coming down," the boy hollered back. "Yeah, we better. Come on, Chicken." "No, let me go." "Yeah, Chicken, Come on now. Sula pulled his leg gently. Let me go. Okay, I'm leaving you. She started on. Wait, he screamed. Sula stopped, and together they slowly worked their way down. Chicken was still elated. I was way up there, wasn't I? Wasn't I? I'ma tell my brother. Sula and Nell began to mimic him. I'ma tell my brother. I'ma tell my brother. Sula picked him up by his hands and swung him outward, then around and around. His knickers ballooned, and his shrieks of frightened joy startled the birds and the fat grasshoppers. When he slipped from her hands and sailed away out over the water, they could still hear his bubbly laughter. The water darkened and closed quickly over the place where Chicken Little sank. The pressure of his hard and tight little fingers was still in Sula's palms as she stood looking at the closed place in the water. They expected him to come back up, laughing. Both girls stared at the water. Nell spoke first. Somebody saw. A figure appeared briefly on the opposite shore. The only house over there was Shadrach's. Sula glanced at Nell. Terror widened her nostrils. Had he seen? The water was so peaceful now. There was nothing but the baking sun and something newly missing. Sula cupped her face for an instant, then turned and ran up to the little plank bridge that crossed the river to Shadrach's house. There was no path. It was as though neither Shadrach nor anyone else ever came this way. Her running was swift and determined, but when she was close to the three little steps that led to his porch, fear crawled into her stomach, and only the something newly missing back there in the river made it possible for her to walk up the three steps and knock at the door. No one answered. She started back, but thought again of the peace of the river. Shadrach would be inside, just behind the door, ready to pounce on her. Still, she could not go back. Ever so gently, she pushed the door with the tips of her fingers and heard only the hinges weep. More. And then she was inside, alone. The neatness, the order startled her, but more surprising was the restfulness. Everything was so tiny, so common, so unthreatening. Perhaps this was not the house of the Shad, the terrible Shad, who walked about with his penis out, who peed in front of ladies and girl children, the only black who could curse white people and get away with it, who drank in the road from the mouth of the bottle, who shouted and shook in the streets. This cottage, this sweet old cottage, with its made-up bed, with its rag rug and wooden table. Sula stood in the middle of the little room and in her wonder forgot what she had come for until a sound at the door made her jump. He was there, in the doorway, looking at her. She had not heard his coming, and now he was looking at her. More in embarrassment than terror, she averted her glance. When she called up enough courage to look back at him, she saw his hand resting upon the doorframe. His fingers, barely touching the wood, were arranged in a graceful arc. Relieved and encouraged, no one with hands like that, no one with fingers that curved around wood so tenderly, could kill her. She walked past him, out of the door, feeling his gaze turning with her. At the edge of the porch, gathering the wisps of courage that were fast leaving her, she turned once more to look at him, to ask him, had he... He was smiling, a great smile, heavy with lust and time to come. He nodded his head as though answering a question, and said in a pleasant conversational tone, a tone of cooled butter, always. Sula fled down the steps and shot through the greenness and the baking sun back to Nell and the dark closed place in the water. There she collapsed in tears. Nell quieted her. Shh, shh, don't. You didn't mean it. It ain't your fault. Shh. Shh. Come on, let's go, Sula. Come on now. Was he there? Did he see? Where's the belt to your dress? Sula shook her head while she searched her waist for the belt. Finally, she stood up and allowed Nell to lead her away. He said, always, always. What? Sula covered her mouth as they walked down the hill. Always. He had answered a question she had not asked, and its promise licked at her feet. A bargeman, poling away from the shore, found Chicken late that afternoon, stuck in some rocks and weeds, his knickers ballooning about his legs. He would have left him there, but noticed that it was a child, not an old black man, as it first appeared, and he prodded the body loose, netted it, and hauled it aboard. He shook his head in disgust at the kind of parents who would drown their own children. When, he wondered, will those people ever be anything but animals, fit for nothing but substitutes for mules? Only mules didn't kill each other the way niggers did. He dumped Chicken Little into a burlap sack and tossed him next to some egg crates and boxes of wool cloth. Later, sitting down to smoke on an empty lard tin, still bemused by God's curse and the terrible burden his own kind had of elevating Ham's sons, he suddenly became alarmed by the thought that the corpse in this heat would have a terrible odor which might get into the fabric of his woolen cloth. He dragged the sack away and hooked it over the side so that the chicken's body was half in and half out of the water. Wiping the sweat from his neck, he reported his find to the sheriff at Porter's Landing, who said they didn't have no niggers in their county, but that some lived in those hills across the river up above Medallion. The bargeman said he couldn't go all the way back there. It was every bit of 2 miles. The sheriff said, why didn't he throw it on back into the water? The bargeman said he never should have taken it out in the first place. Finally, they got the man who ran the ferry twice a day to agree to take it over in the morning. That was why Chicken Little was missing for 3 days and didn't get to the embalmers until the 4th day, by which time he was unrecognizable to almost everybody who once knew him, and even his mother wasn't deep down sure, except that it just had to be him, since nobody could find him. When she saw his clothes lying on the table in the basement of the mortuary, her mouth snapped shut. And when she saw his body, her mouth flew wide open again. And it was 7 hours before she was able to close it and make the first sound. So the coffin was closed. The junior choir, dressed in white, sang, Nearer, My God, to Thee, and Precious Memories. Their eyes fastened on the songbooks they did not need, for this was the first time their voices had presided at a real-life event.